You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, January 19th, 2023, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
How are y'all doing?
Good. How you doing?
I like your use of y'all. I appreciate that.
So, to get right into some interesting conversation, you guys seen that CNET was publishing articles entirely written by ChatGPT, and it was pretty much a disaster.
Well,
the articles or the PR based on the fact that they did it?
Both, because the articles were, a lot of them were just factually incorrect.
My God, they didn't vet them first? That's ridiculous.
Well, that's the question, because they claim that the articles were edited. You know, that they were written by ChatGPT, but then they were edited by their editorial staff. And so the question is, were they really edited? And if they were really edited, how did they let egregious errors get through? There were some math errors, for example, which we know that ChatGPT doesn't do that well. You know, so it's interesting, you know, that this like sort of first foray into just, you know, having ChatGPT write articles didn't go very well. And, you know, and CNET is, you know, I think they're being a little coy about exactly what their process was. So the question was, like, maybe they weren't, you know, editing them as thoroughly as they would a human written article. Maybe the authoritative voice of the articles and the fact that this was written by an AI kind of put the editors off their game, and they maybe didn't look at them that closely. They're like, yeah, this is cogent, you know, there, and they didn't bother like fact checking them. But something went terribly awry.
You'd think that they would want to put them up unedited just because it seems like a stunt.
No, it wasn't. That's the thing. It's not like
that's the problem.
It's not like they were transparent about it. They weren't saying,
that's the problem.
Hey, folks, this was something we produced through ChatGPT. Take a look at it, you know, as a meta article about ChatGPT. They just published it under the byline, like the CNET staff or something.
CNET money staff.
CNET money staff.
Yes.
Not CNET money, robot staff.
Nothing up front letting you know that this was an AI-generated article. You had to do some digging a little bit to reveal that information. It was just not apparent from the first glance.
Interesting. I mean, I personally see this as just growing pains for the technology, you know. Mm. So first of all, be upfront about where the article's coming from, you know, and you'll need to come up with some language about the process, AI generated, but, you know, whatever, editorially reviewed by whoever. And you know, then editors have to know that what ChatGPT can and cannot do, you still have to fact check it, right? It's just sort of regurgitating whatever crap is on the internet, but it's not, it doesn't know what's right and what's not right.
So will the technology get there in that direction of the accuracy? Will it be able to pare that down?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. Can they include some kind of fact-checking in the process itself, you know, like some internal fact-checking, or improve the algorithm so that it relies more, like it somehow can tell like what better information from worse information and then bias, you know, the algorithm towards more reliable information.
Mm-hmm. I wonder that's an interesting idea, though. How would ChatGPT actually fact check? Because you would think that everything it apparently knows, in quotes, right, or understands, would be already fact checked, because that's it went through all the training data. And how does it handle information that's you know, discrepancies where two different sources are saying two different things? I don't know, but yeah, they need some way to do some sort of fact checking, whether maybe it's external to the trading data or rate sources for reliability. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think it's totally doable. Sure.
Yeah.
I would even be satisfied if the chat itself revealed, hey, there are many opinions on this particular thing. For example, XYZ says this and ABC says this. It sort of brings the that level of, well, the fact that it's under, still under discussion or controversy.
Yeah, I agree.
Or whatever
that's a good point. Sometimes it might want to put in its sources into what it's giving you as information. So you have an idea of where it's coming from. And
sure.
Maybe it even rates what it thinks the reliability is.
Reliability, yeah.
Based on what, though?
Well, it has to learn, does it not? It has to.
Yeah, but it just, you know, it goes through billions of websites, and the websites don't have a rating to how reliable they are. So how is it supposed to know?
But they could, you know? Though, Bob. That's the thing. You know, sources can be rated for the amount of trust you're giving them.
Yeah, but then you're putting a limit on the training data, because you want to go through and have a lot of training data, billions of pages, and there's no way you're gonna rate a billion web pages for reliability before you train your.
You could rate, as an example, you could, you know, in each field, say they rate pages that they say are the most trustworthy, right? So at least it knows like what a quote unquote like empirical source of information could be for that topic.
Google has algorithms that it uses to promote better information over worse information. ChatGPT could use similar algorithms to bias its output for information that has certain features, like it comes more from academic sources or nonprofit sources, or whatever, some determination of more authoritative sources, or if some answer is like the 80% answer, then it will favor that over the 20% answer, assuming that the other factors also favor it. So whatever, they could just use some predictive algorithm to say when you train the data. And you have to feed back into the loop, was the answer a correct or not? And then it uses the process to figure out the correct answer over incorrect answers, right? I mean, you just got to build that into, you know, truthiness into the algorithm.
And does the AI actually, quote unquote, learn from that? In other words, it once it realizes that something is more reliable than not, then it will start to ignore the things that are less reliable?
Yeah.
It certainly could. I mean, when you have an extended back and forth chatting with ChatGPT, it everything you discussed with it, it remembers until you close it all out. But yeah, it remembers everything, you know. So it could base answers to your conversation later in the conversation. Those answers will reflect things that, you know, your back and forth, your conversation.
It's still very early in the technology, extremely early. A lot of room for growing.
Yeah, I was listening to just an OpenAI executive, and he was saying how people, he's like, there's just so much misinformation going around about GPT 4.0. And he's like, people are just setting themselves up to be disappointed. He wouldn't commit to a release date, you know, wouldn't even commit to it. Maybe this year, but not definitely this year. He said something interesting. He said that he believes that people, when they used GPT 4.0 or whatever as more of like an assistant, which is kind of where this is all going, where you have a digital assistant that knows you better than you know you. That's what we're heading towards. And I'm just very excited by that, to have an entity, you know, going through the web looking for things it knows I would love, or things that it predicts I would love that I've never seen before, whatever. So he was saying that you should be able to have a conversation with your assistant, and you could say, this is what I want. You know, this is the kind I don't care. You could get a little edgy. You could use sources that are a little, you know, not PC, and that's fine. That's how I want you to be. Or you could have a scenario where you say you're a teacher in school, and you could say, I want my assistant to be locked down, totally safe and PC, and everything on board, nothing, no bias at all, none of that. So you could actually will have a, you know, you will tweak it to, for it to behave the way you want it to behave, to be the best assistant for you.
You know, it'd be cool. Imagine, like, you say, I want my assistant to be Darth Vader.
Yeah.
And then,
that's a terrible idea. I do not want Darth Vader to be my assistant at anything.
No, but you get what I'm saying. Like,
I do. Like, it could have a certain personality.
You give it a personality. Oh, boy.
The problem is it might make decisions based on that personality.
Yeah.
You don't want that.
I just force choked three people that I knew you wouldn't like.
Exactly. Like, ooh, too far.
The other thing about going back to the CNET thing is that the ChatGPT only is trained on data, what was it, up to 2021?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's not very helpful for news.
It's not up to date. Yeah, it's not even up to date.
Yeah, but guys, don't forget, we're still in beta here, man. Like, it's not even, it's open to the public because they want to you know, have a massive increase in data for learning.
But that's exactly why they shouldn't have used it on their platform. That's my point.
Or disclosed that they did do this. They should have been, it should have been apparent, transparent from the get-go.
But I think we, you know, we will be seeing this. Just the, you know, the allure is too great. Especially like the mindless tasks of just writing really just dry copy that's factual, you know, just sort of using a bot to do that, I think is going to be a thing.
Oh, yeah, for
sure. Very, very quickly.
I think so,
too. This is a blip. This is a blip in the road, but
and following like perfect grammatical rule. I mean, that's like one of them. It's like, don't use passive voice. It's like, oh, I got to get so creative right now just to write uncreative stuff.
Steve, what's a blip? Do you mean the CNET thing?
Yeah. CNET fiasco.
Yeah. Because GPT and ChatGPT, that's not going to be a blip.
Yeah. No, and I think the other blip is how universities are handling. I mean, you know, it's like every article. So much of the write around that I'm seeing online right now is about how universities are handling this. Like, what do we do?
The OpenAI CEO said that he compared it to calculators when calculators became a thing, and people just had to deal with the fact that yes, they could bring calculators into tests and they could use them. They just had to deal with it. And
Two things that they did. Like, on the one hand, there were certain scenarios in which they said, now we have to make the test a calculator friendly test. So we've got to test like more complex mental processes. But then on the other hand, they could say no calculators allowed. And that's part of the problem. Like, you know, you can't bring a calculator into your SAT, or at least you couldn't when I took it.
Yeah.
They expect you to do it without a calculator. But so like, you can't be like no chat bots allowed if it's homework. So maybe they're going to do more timed, you know, sit down and write an essay right now. You have the hour.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, there will be ways where teachers will be able to determine the, you know, like there's a high likelihood that this was created using ChatGPT.
Yeah, ChatGPT detection software. Mm-hmm.
That's short term. You know, it's anyone that's even a little industrious will be able to get around that. And it's just, you know, we just got to deal with it and not try to stop it. Because
yeah, it's similar to Turnitin. Like, you guys probably never had to use Turnitin back when you were in school.
No.
And
I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, I didn't have to use it in undergrad or master's, but only in this PhD. So since 2017, I had a couple of classes where you were expected to put your paper through Turnitin, which is like this online platform. And it basically scans it
for plagiarism.
Yeah, and gives you the probability that you plagiarized it.
Oh, wow. Nice.
And it also does – I mean, it's also kind of nice because it's almost got like a Grammarly type software built into it. So it also is like, hey, this is a weird thing and you didn't cite this and blah, blah, blah. But it definitely, like, if you're above a certain percentage, it's basically like other things on the internet are too similar. It's hard when you do super academic papers because there are certain phrases that you always use and those phrases, you know, flag it for plagiarism. So you have to kind of sometimes go through and change the algorithm a little bit. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that does exist. So I don't see why. You know, like you said, they're going to come up with something for ChatGPT too.
Before we move on to some news content, a quick announcement. Science-Based Medicine will be hosting a virtual screening of the movie Virulent, The Vaccine War. It's a great documentary about the anti-vaccine movement and all about vaccine hesitancy and all of that. You can screen it anytime between now and January 29th. And then on Sunday, January 29th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, there will be a live Q&A with me, David Gorski from Science Based Medicine, and the filmmakers, director, producer, Tardis Greenness, and producer, Laura Davis. So the four of us will be available for a live Q&A about the film. They are asking for a suggested donation of $12.50. That's the early bird rate. That goes up to $15 on Tuesday, January 24th. So a nominal fee to help support the film, to get it out there, you know, spread the word as much as possible. So we would appreciate you doing that. And you can get the link and all the information on Science-Based Medicine. The announcement, I believe, is pinned to the top, but you'll see it very quickly, the virtual screening Q&A for Virulent. All right, Jay, you're starting us off with a quickie with Jay. You're going to tell us about intermittent fasting.
Ooh.
But only tell us a little bit at a time.
So according to a recent study on fasting versus calorie restriction, what they found was that eating less overall was the only effective way to lose weight. So they had 550 adults, 18 years or older, and they tracked them for 6 years. They were using a mobile app to keep track of
6 years.
What they ate, what time they ate, when they slept.
Screw that, man. That's a lot of work.
And the data found the following. So they found that meal timing was not associated with weight change during the six-year follow-up period. And this includes the interval from first to last meal, from waking up to eating a first meal, from eating the last meal to going to sleep, and total sleep duration. The total daily number of large meals estimated at more than 1,000 calories and medium meals estimated at 500 to 1,000 calories were each associated with increased weight over the six-year follow-up, while fewer small meals estimated at less than 500 calories were associated with decreasing weight.
Really? Which,
yep.
Right, but you did say the total number of large meals.
Total daily number of large meals.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you're only taking one large meal versus three large meals, you might have seen some similarity with one large meal and five small meals, for example.
Sure.
Yeah. Because you said it's really just the number of calories.
It does come down to the calories. So yeah. The average time from the first to last meal was 11.5 hours, which if you think about like when you eat dinner or when's the last thing that you eat and then you get up and then you have breakfast, you know, is how long is that interval? And apparently the average for this group was 11.5 hours. And they said that the study did not detect an association between meal timing and weight change in a population with a wide range of body weight. You know, the summary here is that it really came down to and only came down to how many calories you're eating in the 24-hour period. So fasting, you know, saving all your calories for one meal or, you know, fasting in any way, which is just putting more time in between meals, didn't do anything.
Well, I think what we're leaving out, though, is the psychological component of that. So for some people, the way for them to restrict their calories is to not eat most of the day and then eat a lot in one sitting because there's only so much one can eat in one sitting.
Yeah, I totally get that. I mean, people use fasting as a way to control what they're doing. It's a method, but
right.
It isn't in and of itself. Fasting is just a tool, but it's not.
Right.
It doesn't do the operative thing here, which is lose weight.
That's a great way to put it. It's a tool that works for some people based on their own eating habits and their own style.
Yeah.
And what they can tolerate and what they can't.
Right. If you could eat a small breakfast, lunch, and dinner and, you know, restrict your calories, if you could do that and lose weight, that's great. Or if you're the kind of person that needs to, you know, go for it in like an 18-hour run, but, you know, an 18-hour span where you're not eating and you have, you know, just like, you know, one big meal and –
thanks.
Then that's good. That's fine too. It doesn't matter. You can't be anal about the timing and the amounts of food that you eat. It's all about absolute number of calories. That's the takeaway. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
And probably what that's really showing, if we look, because right, this is aggregate data, is if we looked at each individual person, different things work for different people. You know, it's like, just like you said, some people probably need to eat a tiny amount every hour because they need to like regulate their blood sugar better and they're in a better mood when they do that. And just overall, they feel better.
Yeah, it's just more evidence that the only thing that really matters when it comes to weight is calories in, calories out. And that other things are just nibbling around the edges. I mean, I can't say it has zero effect, but it's not significant.
Yeah, don't focus on cardio to lose fat because it's not going to be the main driver. It'll be a very minimal driver
of good
fat
for
loss.
You overall.
It's great for you for other reasons.
It's great for so many reasons.
For other reasons.
But if you want to lose weight, you need to eat fewer calories.
That's it. Yeah. That's the 80-20 or 90-10 of losing fat is eating fewer calories.
But people love to focus on that 10%, man. That's
oh my God, right?
It's very important to eat a varied diet and to eat green leafy vegetables.
Yeah, get your micronutrients. Yeah.
You got to have that variation or else you're not going to get everything that you need. Mm. And it's super easy to have a limited diet and basically not be getting the nutrition that that your body needs.
Yeah, I'm fine with vegetables at this point, but for me, it's still I don't eat enough fruit at all. It's just like
I love fruit.
You got to have it in the house ready to go, right, Ev? You got to have it.
Yeah, banana. You got to have the.
It doesn't matter.
I've got the clementines this time of year. They're perfect.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't matter. Liz was laughing at me because she's like, "Yep, I had to throw out the two apples we had." We had just two apples for a week, and they weren't touched. And like, oh, can't eat these now. Oh, like, God. Holy crap! Even two pieces of fruit, we have a problem eating. So it's like,
I eat probably a dozen apples a week.
Oh, if there's apples in the house,
screw apples, man. They're not. they are not. In terms of, if you like them, that's fine. Eat them. They're delicious. I love them.
You get some vitamin.
In terms of pure nutrition. No. Apples just don't have a lot of nutrition compared to other fruits.
They've got fiber.
Better for you. Get strawberries. Get a little box of strawberries. Not much more else. You could titrate them.
Blueberries, very,
very
good.
Well. You know, there's a lot of nutrition in them. They're
Bob, you know what
delicious.
You can do? What? This is what I do. So, because I think, Bob, you may struggle with something similar to what I struggle with, which is not living alone. I live alone, so it's just me. But like the smaller the household number, the harder it is to keep a lot of like fresh food in the house because it just goes bad really fast.
Yeah.
And you can't always eat like the whole bag of salad or the whole whatever. And yes, you can buy a single apple, so that's not really an excuse. But one of the things that I do, because I don't eat enough fruit either, is I keep frozen berries and I just make smoothies a lot with frozen berries.
Mm-hmm. That's a great idea.
Yeah. That's not bad.
They last forever.
Berries are good.
Yeah.
Right?
I make my kids smoothies with that same thing, Kara. And you think about like – because I'm also putting spinach and kale and
– yeah, you can. You can add all sorts. And I put yogurt. Protein powder in them.
Yeah. Yogurt. It's the way to go.
So it's super good for you. And then they never go bad. They're just always ready for you in the freezer.
You better fix that shit, Bob. You got to eat. You got to eat, man.
Wow. Well, you got to move away from a dozen apples a day and go get a better fruit.
He said a week, by the way, not a day.
I eat everything. I buy all different kinds of stuff.
All
I'm constantly shaking it up. Don't worry about me. Worry about yourself.
Well, that was some quickie. All right.
It was a smoothie quickie.
Kara, tell us about the effects of using all of these tech devices on our brain development.
Ooh, okay.
Is it good?
Is it good?
Okay. Is it bad?
So there's a really fascinating study that was just published in NeuroImage called Technologically Assisted Communication. Here's the giveaway. Attenuates Interbrain Synchrony.
Ooh,
okay, what does
nice.
That mean? So these researchers from the University of Montreal, they came up with a pretty ingenious experimental design. They recruited pairs of mothers and basically like adolescent children. They ranged in age between 10 and 14. The average age was 12. And they set up an interesting paradigm. They looked at three different test conditions. In one test condition, the mom and the child sat side by side and just stared at the wall. So it was sort of like a control condition. In another condition, the mom and the child sat facing each other in the same room, and they had some kind of pre-planned conversation. So basically, they told them, plan a camping trip together or talk about a trip that you want to take to an amusement park. So something exciting. And then they talked. And then in the third condition, they did the exact same thing, but instead of sitting across from each other, they were online. They were across a screen. So they were in separate rooms, the doors were locked, and they were only communicating via like Zoom or whatever. And they used a really interesting – I had to look this up because I didn't know about this scanning technology because it's super, super new. I think it only just started like – I don't know. A lot of the articles about it are from like 2020, 2021, 2016. But I found something from the early 2000s, but maybe it was like still very new then, called hyperscanning EEG. So hyperscanning EEG is – you guys know about traditional EEG, right? Electroencephalography. Mm-hmm. Okay. So hyperscanning electroencephalography actually is simultaneous readings from two different people who are engaged in a social task to try and find synchrony in the brain waves. So it's not just that we want to see what brain waves are happening at any given time. We want to see, are they synchronizing? Because there's a fair amount of evidence that shows that when – individuals are socially engaged, that certain things synchronize in the brain. We've also seen this in animals. There's like a lot of animal models of this. But this is like a relatively kind of new-ish area of research, is this kind of social neurological activity. And so what do you think they found in these different test paradigms?
I think they found you could catch COVID by synchronizing brains.
Do they think it found more or less synchrony in which group?
Oh, face-to-face. Come on.
That would be my guess, more face-to-face.
Right. So more face-to-face. And what would you say if I told you that you're right, but that also they found only one synchronous brain region that they tested when they were looking across the computer and nine when they were face-to-face.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
And these are different areas. So it's not like they were, and they're pretty broad though. I mean, this is EEG, right? So it's just looking at brain waves and it's picking it up from the skull. So basically we're not going to get down to like the nitty gritty of exactly where these things were occurring in the brain. But they found, and I want to kind of highlight this because I think this is the meat here. In face-to-face interaction, they saw a wide net of connections. They saw same region, same hemisphere links. They saw same region, different hemisphere links, and then they saw multi-region patterns of connectivity. They especially were interested in, based on previous research, areas where the mother and the child's frontal and temporal regions were oscillating at the same frequency, the frequency that a lot of these same oscillations occurred at tended to be beta, kind of in the beta zone. But the one link that connected the brains during the video chat was between the mother's right frontal region of her brain and the child's left temporal region of the brain. So basically what they didn't see between mom and child across the computer was right-to-right linkage, which was concerning because right-to-right linkage tends to be like where we're seeing a lot of that like prosody of speech, the social interaction, a lot of the things that we think of as being important for kind of like empathy and for learning social cues. So this empathic engagement and this social learning, the authors have a rich literature review in here about how important it is for kids to develop pro-social skills, like basically cognitive, social cognition. Like when somebody makes that face and then they use that tone of voice, what are they telling me? Are they being sarcastic right now? Are they being authentic with me? You know, if their eyes go over here, what does that mean? Like, what are all these social cues? These are things we learn when we're really young. And so the researchers basically said, we need a ton more research to know what this actually means, but it does worry us about the kids that are doing all online education right now, because we're seeing that their brains are not reacting the same way when we look at two people who are engaging with one another as if they were face to face. And that is disconcerting. They go on to say, we did not study this specifically, but we speculate and would love to see somebody else, or maybe later on we will study, that this may contribute to that Zoom fatigue that so many people talk about. Because if you're on Zoom and your brain isn't naturally synchronizing with the person that you're on Zoom with, it's going to take more mental effort to try and read their cues and to try to like basically use empathy and social engagement that would have happened maybe more naturally and less effortfully if you were in face-to-face communication. So they hypothesize that maybe that's why people feel more exhausted by engaging socially on a computer than they do face-to-face, because they actually need more effort and more energy to get the same social cues. It's interesting. I mean, I think it's a pretty robust study. I think it's pretty smart and clean and easy. It was pre-registered. They did a lot of like good science and statistics in it, obviously. And they're pretty good about saying like, you know, these are things we're concerned about and we need to study more. We're not saying this is exactly what's happening. We're not saying because your brains aren't as synchronous as they are face-to-face, therefore kids are lacking empathy, or therefore kids aren't learning social skills. Like, they're not jumping to that, but they're saying there's a concern here that we should probably address and study more. What do you think about it, Steve? I mean, I'm curious because I know this is probably fascinating to you, as fascinating to you as it is to me.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this kind of data is so complicated to interpret because there are so many possible pathways of cause and effect. But I think the basic concept that our brains basically do function on these two levels. This is like the thinking fast, thinking slow kind of concept, where things that it does a lot, it automates, and it does in the background unconsciously and efficiently, but you always have the ability to do things from the top down, you know, with more analytical and more conscious, and it takes a lot more energy
and time.
And more, you know, yeah, more mental energy, more effort, but it's also more versatile and more specific, you know, meaning that like when you do an analysis, you actually crunch the numbers as to saying, it feels like this, you know, So in this, all of our social stuff, it does tend to be very automatic in the background, efficient, use, you know, minimal energy for the neurotypical person, I should say.
Exactly.
There are people that, that aren't typical for whom social interactions are extremely energetic. They are exhausting. Yeah. Things that most people would take for granted, they find utterly exhausting because they don't have those modules of automatic synchronization.
And they only looked at neurotypical pairs in this study. But so the important kind of thing is that kids don't just know how to have social intelligence. They learn it through experience. And when we think about academics, that's built in a little. I do think that more and more, like recently, because we have such good, such a good understanding of child development and psychology and social psychology and all of that, that's thought about when planning curriculum, right? Kids in kindergarten are learning social skills intentionally now, but so much of it is still happening in the background. You might be learning algebra, but you're learning algebra in a classroom where you're engaging with the teacher and where you're seeing the teacher's micro expressions and where you're making eye contact with the other students. And that is the part that the authors are saying is sadly and kind of scarily probably getting lost.
Yeah.
And that part might be pretty foundational to outcomes later in life. They do point to studies, they didn't study this at all, but they do point to studies about, you know, psychopathology that happens in when the pair bonding isn't there. And they've actually been able to look at like animal models where they disrupt synchrony and the animals are less interested in making eye contact and they don't spend as much time together.
Mm-hmm.
So we do see, I mean, I think it's not a leap to say that this is fundamental for this behavior, but you're right with the cause and effect question that's not answered by this study.
Yeah.
What's great about hyperscanning EEG though, is that it has a high level of ecological validity because they were able to counterbalance. It wasn't like they were comparing one group that sat face to face to another group that sat across the computer. All groups did all conditions and they compared their own brains. So that really shows you that there is a fundamental difference between these different tasks because all the other variables are kept controlled when you're able to use the same people and just match them against these different conditions.
Yeah.
So some did one first, some did the other first, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like they use good experimental design.
Yeah, and it's always one of those studies where like the questions it generates are more interesting than the actual findings. And you know, it suggests a line of research that you really want to see how it plays out.
And they wrote about that well. They were very good at doing exactly what good scientists do, which is saying, although we didn't study this explicitly, and although we can't make any claims to this, we wonder if, and it would be important if more people study, or we worry that, and it would be important if more people study this phenomenon. So I appreciated that.
All right, let's go on. So the latest cancer statistics are out. It's the 2023 report, which basically covers data through 2020, because, you know, it takes a couple of years to really crunch all the data. So what do you guys think? And actually, this does include some data through 2022 as well. But specifically in the 2023 report, they looked at a lot of data, but they looked specifically at the death rate from cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of ways you could look at the, you know, how much cancer is out there, basically. You could look at the incidence, like how many new people get diagnosed with cancer. You could look at the severity of the cancer, you know, at the point that it's being diagnosed. You could look at survival, like once you get the diagnosis, how long do you survive? And you could also look at the death rate, just how many people are dying from cancer. The death rate is kind of all of those things combined. Right?
Yeah, right.
Because obviously the more people who get cancer, the more people are going to die from it. But of course, the better it's treated, the fewer people who are going to die from it. The older people live, the more people are going to be getting cancer. And therefore, the more people are going to be dying from it. The more cancers we capture diagnostically, the numbers go up. And if we're sort of not capturing it, then we could be missing numbers. So there's a lot of things potentially going on statistically, epidemiologically within that number. And when you delve into very specific cancers, we can't assume that. But if you look at all of the cancer,
right? Yeah.
What do you guys think in general?
It's getting better.
You know,
Yeah. Detection's up and survivability's up.
Incrementally.
But
down.
Again, let's look at just the death rate. Let's focus on that one.
Death rate has gone down.
Death rate? It's got to go down.
It's got to go down, right? And basically because treatment's getting better.
Yeah. But that's not what we saw right, like early on after the, quote, war on cancer. We actually saw, because of all of those things that you mentioned.
Well, initially, when you go from not diagnosing to diagnosing, the numbers are, you know, they skyrocket. You know?
Yeah, exactly. But that's and it not looks the, so much worse. But
it's
you're
not the
just,
real numbers. It's just the recorded numbers. So that's
and also, when we have these incredible treatments, like you mentioned, that keep people alive longer, we see some changes, some epidemiological changes downstream from that as well. There's a really good, by the way, if you haven't read The Emperor of All Maladies, Siddhartha Mukherjee, I highly, highly recommend it because he dives deep into exactly this. I mean, it's only one component. He gives the whole history of cancer, but it's one really good component. Like how we measure cancer has a lot of bias in it and a lot of caveating that we have to do.
Yeah, one thing that is interesting statistically is what's called lead time bias. If you get better at diagnosing cancers at an earlier stage, it will appear as if people survive longer with cancer just from that fact alone, even if they're not getting better treated. But let's go back to, say, 1991 when, you know, that's the last 30 years when basically we've been using the same methods. You know, we kind of worked out all of this stuff and the surveillance and everything had plateaued and any differences over the last 30 years are probably mostly from actual treatment. So what do you think the reduction in cancer deaths have been over the last 30 years?
What do you mean? How are you asking?
As a percentage?
How much? Give me one percentage for the last 30 years. From 1991 to 2020.
From 1991? I mean, we already had so many good drugs then. Yeah,
let's without cheating, I would have guessed 49%.
Wow, that high? 20% then? I don't
25
know.
25 for me.
33%.
That's great.
So that's more than 1% per year, a little bit more than 1% per
year. That's
incredible. That has been the rate. It's been 1% per year basically for the last three decades.
That's incredible.
It is incredible. It's like battery technology and all that stuff. It's like this
steadily moving
forward. Incremental 1% per year, like clockwork almost. There was a question actually, and some people were anticipating this report was, did we lose ground during the pandemic? And the answer is no. Actually, from 2019 to 2020, the cancer deaths declined by 1.5%, a little bit above average for the last 30 years.
Awesome.
So, yeah, the pandemic, if it did have a factor, it was overwhelmed by new treatments. There's also prevention, right? If you prevent cancers, that also reduces the death rate. So what do you think the biggest cancer was specifically in terms of reduction in cancer deaths? And especially in the last 5 to 10 years, that's a sort of a big hint.
5 to 10 years. Oh, that's a big hint. Really?
Yeah.
Shit. Not long. Lymphoma. I'm trying to think. There's so many different factors here because now we have immunotherapy, which is like amazing.
So I'll tell you the incidence of this cancer decreased from 2012 to 2019, right, over those 7 years, decreased by 65%.
Whoa.
Oh, cervical?
Nice.
Yes, cervical
Yeah,
cancer.
Because of the HPV vaccine.
HPV, absolutely.
Oh, vaccination.
Nice. Fuckers.
That's what the biggest, I think, set of information in this data is this dramatic drop in the incidence of cervical cancer. 65% drop, which of course then leads the death is a little bit delayed because, you know, people take time to die basically. So so we're anticipating in the future that the death numbers from cervical cancer are going to really go down. And that 65 drop should continue to decrease because of, there's actually really good herd immunity with the HPV vaccine.
Yeah.
Good.
Quick background.
Well, there has to be because guys,
people spread it. Right? This is a communicable virus.
Vectors out there.
Yeah. So, this is the human papillomavirus, actually quite a number of different human papillomaviruses, and they they cause virtually all cervical cancer.
Yep.
They also cause cancer of the vulva, vagina, penis, anus, and oropharynx. Not as much as the as cervical cancer, again, which is virtually all. So for those people who were, they said sexually active females aged 14 to 24 who were vaccinated showed a 90% reduction in infections with HPV 16 or 18. And those who were not vaccinated showed a 74% reduction in infections.
Oh, that's the herd.
That's the herd immunity. So even if you were not vaccinated, then you still see the reduction. It's just less circulating around.
But they were looking at what age range?
Sexually active females aged 14 to 24.
That's why. Yeah. Because you see that anybody above, like basically my age and older, not only are they not vaccinated, but neither are their partners. Mm-hmm. The herd immunity has a very clean break in age range. So it depends on who, you know, the age of your sexual partners, but there is a year at which, and it sucks because we had to chase it. I'm finally vaccinated, but I wasn't able to get vaccinated when I was young.
It
wasn't available?
No, it wasn't approved. It wasn't approved for people my age, so insurance wouldn't cover it, and it's an insanely expensive vaccine.
Oh, interesting.
There is a huge difference state by state in the U.S. in terms of uptake of the HPV vaccine. Mississippi was the worst. 13 to 17-year-old girls in Mississippi only have a 32% uptake.
That's horrifying.
Now, that is not necessarily related to the politics of Mississippi, although that certainly is a factor, but it's also because they just also have the worst health care in the United States.
Yeah, and which is also related to education.
Yeah. It's all kind of ties together, but it's not like one simple cause and effect. It's not just hesitancy.
But are there places where the vaccine's mandated? I think there are.
So the other lowest state is West Virginia at 43%. Mm-hmm. The states with a high proportion are Massachusetts, 73%, Hawaii, 74%, and Rhode Island, 83%. Those are the highest. So that's a big difference, like twice as much. From lowest to highest, even more.
But it should be more. It should be even more than that. It should be 100%. There's no reason.
Plus, but there's a lot of vaccine hesitancy out there, and parents are very anxious about vaccinating their kids. And
there's also
a lot of misinformation and
puritanical stuff about why would I vaccinate an 11-year-old against an STI? It's like the whole point is that you're vaccinating them before they're sexually active.
Exactly. You're right. There's some puritanicalism or whatever there. But vaccine hesitancy and the anti-vaccine movement is definitely playing a role. And this is just another example of how it kills, you know, how misinformation absolutely kills. We have a vaccine that prevents cancer. I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
And it works.
And this
it
is
works
clearly
immensely.
That's like Star Trek medicine, man. Here's a vaccine against cancer. Hello.
And this is clearly near and dear to my heart, and it should be to any adult over a certain age who's listening to this show who didn't have access to that vaccine but knows that their kids do. Why? I mean, obviously, I got cervical cancer from this very reason. I'm very lucky that I caught it early, but I had to have a pretty life-altering operation.
Oh, wow. That's right.
And then, like, of course, I also have the vaccine now, so I feel like I'm safe kind of moving forward for the future. But, like, your daughters and sons, by the way, may never have to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
I think about chickenpox, too. Like, we are of a generation, everybody who's talking on the show, where we all just had to get chickenpox. But now young people are vaccinated against chickenpox.
I got my chickenpox.
Yeah,
we all just had to get
early
it.
Early 80s, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There were chickenpox parties.
Yeah, it was horrible. It was a terrible idea. But now...
I never got it.
You never got the chickenpox?
Nope. And the thing is, now we all have a risk of shingles because of this.
Yeah.
But there's a shingles vaccine.
Now there's a shingles vaccine. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, thank goodness.
So the other pullout of this data that's worth talking about is the prostate cancer risk, which for the first time in 20 years went up.
But isn't that because we've changed all the screening things so much?
But it's not just screening. Yeah. So this is an interesting story of how to balance the benefits and risks of doing screening. So prior to 20 years ago, it was standard of care to do prostate-specific antigen, which is a blood test in all men over age 50, in order to screen for prostate cancer. But then prostate cancer rates, you know, went significantly down, you know. Well, actually, it was kind of both, where they initially went up because we were catching more of it, but people were surviving longer with it because we were catching it earlier, right? So actually it caused an increase in prostate cancer diagnoses. Then there was data which showed that, you know what, there's a huge false positive rate to this, and then there are a lot of men who are getting unnecessary procedures. Maybe it's not a good screening test. So then the recommendation was to not do it routinely. And then prostate cancer diagnoses plummeted, but they didn't go away. We just weren't diagnosing them because we weren't screening.
Right.
But then, the data started to show that, now that we're not routinely using PSA for screening, men are being diagnosed later in the course of their prostate cancer where the treatments are not as effective and the interventions are more invasive. And maybe this isn't such a good idea. So now, and this is now the first time to show that, now that we're not routinely screening, more men are dying from prostate cancer. So maybe we overreacted, to the false positive. So now they're kind of compromising in the middle, saying, okay, for men over 50, we're not saying that you need to get screened with PSA or that you shouldn't get screened with PSA. Just talk about it with your doctor and make an individualized decision with informed consent. So they're basically punting, to the individual practitioners, which I guess is better because like either extreme of always doing it and never doing it wasn't good. And so, okay, we'll compromise in the middle, but I'm not sure, like I'm 58. Should I get my PSA done? I guess I would do it, and just deal with a false positive if it happens. Of course, you don't know if it's a false positive or a true positive.
Well, then they have to do a biopsy.
So what's your, so what's the question? Do you want to get a biopsy that you might not need, or you want to delay your diagnosis?
I mean, they've done this for cervical cancer forever. We get PAPs, when I was young, we got a PAP every year. Now they're able to move it to every 3 years. But and you get an abnormal PAP, you get a biopsy, and it sucks. Trust me, they don't give us anesthesia. You get anesthesia for your biopsy.
Not always, actually.
Oh, okay.
but, no, they don't. I spoke to patients. They just go in there, and it's a punch biopsy, and blood comes out, and it's a out of your penis, and it's a nightmare.
Ah! Yeah.
Wait, but I mean, they got to go through that.
Yeah. That's standard practice for.
I'm not doing that again.
Is there another way?
That's standard practice for women in our cervixes. Like nobody gets. I have a question for you, Steve.
The good news is there's new markers and imaging that we could use instead of a biopsy. You still may end up with the biopsy, but you might be able to skirt it. So not every false positive PSA gets an unnecessary biopsy necessarily.
I'm also wondering if there's this, I don't know what the epidemiologic, what the name for it is, but basically I remember when my dad was diagnosed and, it was very, very early stage, was able to have it all removed. It was fine. But his physician basically said, all men will get, not all, but most men will get prostate cancer if they live long enough. And he was saying, if you look at an autopsy of an elderly man, X percent of elderly men knew that they had prostate cancer or will die of prostate cancer, but then this way larger percent will have it on autopsy even though they didn't even know they had it. It's just a function of the older we get, the higher our risk is.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, is that number going up also part of lifespan or life expectancy going up?
Oh, yeah. Yes. So cancers go up as life expectancy goes up as well.
But that's prostate especially.
Prostate is one of those ones that's very age-related.
Right. Absolutely. It's like ovarian for women and prostate for men tend to be two. That just the older you get, the more likely your chance of getting it is.
Yeah, totally.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and on a happy note, if you translate those numbers, these statistics to the number of cancer deaths avoided since 1991, it's 3.8 million.
Wow.
In the U.S., 3.8 million people in the U.S. since 1991, fewer deaths from cancer based upon the new treatments and screening and, prevention, et cetera. So it is good. I mean, the new treatment, every now and then I'll talk about some new treatment coming online. It really is the technology. It's because new technology is being introduced. We have so many more ways of treating cancer now than we did 30 years ago. And there's more coming online. The CRISPR stuff is coming online now. Mm-hmm. And so there's every reason to expect that 1% per year or more is going to continue to happen into the future.
Yeah.
It's awesome. All right, Jay, tell us about short sleeper syndrome.
Have you guys ever heard someone say that they only need 5 to 6 hours of sleep?
Yeah, I have heard that.
From others, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do hear people say that, right? So a typical person would need 7 to 9 hours of sleep to be fully rested. I am definitely in that category. Being fully rested meaning that you don't have a sleep deficit of any sort. The idea that some people actually needing less sleep than others is called short sleeper syndrome. It's actually a name for it. And what this means is that some people can get fully rested from a shorter amount of sleep, you know, than typical. So as a skeptic, when I hear about this, you know, anybody saying, I don't need that much sleep, a red flag always has gone up for me. I always question, like, you know, how true that is. And, you know, I would imagine there'd be some variability, but, you know, anybody that was trying to pass it off like they could survive on 6 hours of sleep never seemed reasonable to me. So the question is, does the short sleeper syndrome exist in the first place? Is it biologically feasible that a person can only need 5 to 6 hours of sleep to get the same benefit as the typical 7 to 9 hours? So there is some science behind this. As an expert in the field of sleep named Andrew Coogan, who is a behavioral neurologist at Maynooth University in Ireland, says that short sleeper syndrome does exist for sure. He says that there are people who can get a full night of rest from 6 or less hours of sleep where they don't experience
waiting for that.
6 or fewer.
The next time I say it, I will say or fewer.
All right.
So six hours or fewer hours of sleep where they don't experience adverse effects from sleeplessness. They don't have cognitive impairment or lowered mood and the other typical things that happen when you are operating inside of a sleep deficit. So to many people, this would be an amazing thing, right, Bob? I've heard Bob say our entire life, how Bob would love to be one of those people that only needs, you know, 4, 5, or 6 hours of sleep.
Yeah. I love sleep, man. Don't get me wrong. I dig it. I don't want to get up and I look forward to getting into bed and get all comfortable. But if it could be 2 or 3 hours, even 4 or 5 would be great too. I don't need as much sleep as Jay, but I need a good 7 or 8. And it's such a waste of time. God damn it.
Well, the brain needs it though.
Yeah. Some, most. But I've had patients before who, I mean, it was interesting because they were also usually like ADHD or high level anxiety patients. But yeah, who were like had so much energy, and they slept 4 hours a night, and they were like rested and woke up with like more energy than most people who have 8 to 10, and that's just how they were their whole lives.
As a father with 2 kids, you know, young kids. I'm getting between 6 and 7 hours a night. That's my calculation on what I'm averaging throughout the week. And it is not even close to enough.
Yeah, you must feel so just like zombied all the time.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. I mean, you know, and it's remarkable because when I do catch a good night of sleep, you know, I wake up and I'm like, oh my God, you know, like, you know, the difference is profound. So getting back to this, so researchers think that genetics are the cause, right? Of course, that makes a ton of sense here. You know, you can't learn how to live with less sleep. No amount of practice is going to ever get you there. You have to be born with this. Families that have short sleeper syndrome seem to have genes that likely are the cause. So there's a couple of studies here that support this. A 2014 study published in the journal Sleep determined that a variant of a gene called BHLHE41, not that that means anything to any of us, but that gene is connected to this phenomenon, giving those who have the gene a resistance to sleep deprivation. I thought that was an interesting way for the researchers to put it, right? Having a resistance to sleep deprivation.
Yeah, I like that.
In this study, they concluded that having this gene mutation will allow a person to sleep less and resist the effects of sleep loss. And then another study in 2019 that was published in the journal Neuron concluded that a mutation in a gene called ADRB1 led to a short sleep trait in humans. So in this study, they estimated that approximately 4 people in 100,000 have the mutation. And this is an incredibly small percentage. I mean, we're talking about 0.004% of the population was their estimate of who would actually have this. Not common, definitely something that they need to make CRISPR give to all of us. If that were possible, that would be amazing. Imagine getting a CRISPR treatment that makes it so you only need to get 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night. Could you imagine if that is ever on the table? So then, of course, the question is, how do you know if you have this mutation? So Coogan said that if you don't sleep longer when you actually have the opportunity, right? So we were talking about like on the weekend, let's say Saturday morning, you don't have to get up early, but do you still get up at the same time?
Yes.
God, no.
Sleep in.
Yeah, you sleep in. Like, so most people will take advantage of the extra sleep time and sleep during that time. Then he said, but then you might have the mutation. I think he's saying if you're getting 6 hours or less a night, and then when you do have the opportunity to sleep, you still only want six hours or less, that might be an indicator. However, this is a big however, it is much more likely that even if you think you're a short sleeper, you probably aren't. And he said most people just become accustomed to less sleep, but they're still doing damage over the long haul. And it's important to note that the amount of sleep each person needs is down to the individual. You know, it is an individual thing. There isn't a time that everybody needs, of course. Like, you know, there are people that need more than 8 hours of sleep. I think, you know, we average out to be somewhere between 7 and 9. And then the other important thing that was brought up was that the amount of sleep that you need can and typically does change during your lifetime. The obvious one is that children need more sleep, but children and teens need more sleep than the average population. And then, you know, when you're in your later years, you know, the amount of sleep that you need could change to needing less sleep. So very interesting. Now, there are some famous people that have made claims that they are short, you know, they require less sleep. Like Margaret Thatcher was very well known for claiming that she only needed 4 hours of sleep. And then there, you know, there's the idea, like, you know, is this a trait that a lot of rich and famous people have? You know, Obama said this and Elon Musk said this.
That they only that they needed fewer hours of sleep than.
Yes. Yeah. That they survive on 6 or less. Okay. And I don't know. I don't know if I believe that, to be honest with you. I'm highly skeptical because, again, the percentages here are so low. And I don't think that there's any, like, if you can handle having 2 hours less of sleep, it's not like you're twice as productive as the next person. You're not.
No, you're not. But those two, I think it's hard for those of us who need a lot of sleep to imagine what the day would look like. But it's literally that they have 2 extra hours in their day where they're as alert as we are.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing too. And there's probably a sampling bias here. You know, it's hard to believe because all these people are saying it, all these famous people, but there's probably a sampling bias. That might be partially why they are who they are.
Could be, yeah.
Or it might contribute to them, you know, having gotten that far ahead in business or politics or whatever, because, you know, that whole, I get more done by 9 a.m. than you do in a whole day. Like, some people are very productive in the morning and some people jump out of bed with a lot of energy. Which I hate those people.
High five.
Jen says I'm one of those people. She says
I'm on the other end of the spectrum. If I consistently get 8 hours of sleep a night, I feel like I have a sleep deficit on the weekends. 8 hours is not enough for me each night. I'm exhausted with only 8.
Wow.
Yeah, that's full. Again, see the variability. You know, mm-hmm. like you're probably more of a 9 hour person.
Carrie, do you sleep
9 to 10?
Do you sleep well for those 8 hours? Or
I sleep very well, and mm-hmm. I've actually had a proper like full sleep study. You know, where I was diagnosed with a sleep disorder, but it wasn't because of my nighttime sleep. My nighttime sleep is fully restorative. I go through all of my phases. They were like your night sleep is very high quality sleep. Okay. Yet I'm still tired all the time.
All right, Bob, tell us about the hungriest black hole.
Nom, 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 nom.
Yes. Sounds like a kid's book.
It does.
Yeah, I found an interesting black hole in Quasar recently, and I thought it would be a really interesting discussion. The black hole in the Quasar, or perhaps comprising it, is the most ravenous ever found, and it weighs in at 34 billion times the mass of our sun.
Wow.
This was reported in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. So I'm going to talk about quasars a bit because they're awesome. They were a mystery when they were discovered. They were just people, scientists were like, what is happening? What is this? When radio astronomy really got going in the 50s, they did their very first whole radio sky surveys, and they found these anomalous and incredibly energetic radio sources with no optical light, meaning that there was radio light, but there was no UV, visible or infrared light that was associated with it. So what was this? It's just like bare, intense radio waves. So after years, though, they started finding some of them that were associated also with visible light. Especially, I think the first ones were blue light. So they looked at that light spectrum, and they wanted to see what chemicals were there, but it made no sense. They could not interpret it. The light also varied very quickly, meaning that whatever these things were, they could only be on the scale of a solar system in size and no larger. Otherwise, the light variation could not happen as fast as it was happening. So, okay. So we had something very small and incredibly intense. So they call them quasi-stellar radio sources, which was shortened to QUASAR, which is a wonderful acronym. The term QUASAR then was like the terms dark matter and dark energy, a name given for something we know shit about. You know, it's like, let's just throw this name at it because we don't know what this is. So eventually, and after much debate, a surprising amount of debate actually, it was realized that the spectra from these quasars made sense when you factored in a huge redshift because of their incredible distance and the expansion of space, which after billions of years stretched out the light frequencies, causing the weird spectra. So it also meant that they were billions of light years away, not just hundreds of millions, but billions of light years away. And they were still so visible, they had to be just energetic beyond relief, beyond belief. Because if they were like a million light years away or at the edge of the galaxy or whatever, then they would be, you know, they'd be powerful, but not that powerful. But if they were that far away, they were just insane. And some scientists didn't even believe that they could be that far away, mainly purely because have to be too energetic. So eventually, of course, we realized that supermassive black holes with millions or billions of solar masses were in these galaxies, and they were actively feeding on anything nearby that was smeared into an accretion disk of gas that was swirling down the black hole drain ever faster, and in the process, releasing stupid amounts of energy. That's what these were. These types of galaxies now often go by the more precise initialism, AGN, for active galactic nuclei, which is nice, but quasar is still a lot cooler. So then this leads then to the quasar that was discovered called SMS J215 blah, 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 15.1. I'm going to call it quasar J2. I hate these long names. This quasar looked interesting, so they said, let's take a really close look. They used the Keck telescope, among others, and they discovered that it was 12.5 billion light years away. That's crazy far. The light that we were seeing left when the universe was only 1.25 billion years old. Very little baby universe. Not only that, it was the most luminous and most powerful quasar ever seen. Whoa. This thing was just off the hook. So now such a quasar has got to have a special supermassive black hole inside, right? I'll call this black hole J2. It did not disappoint. Its mass topped out, as I said, at 34 billion solar masses. That's 8,000 times bigger than the Milky Way's central black hole. And I have serious black hole envy, I got to say. This thing is amazing. There are whole galaxies that are less massive than this black hole. I mean, it's just so if you put black hole, get this, this is something. If you put black hole J2 where the sun is now, its 200 billion kilometer diameter would encompass the entire solar system, depending on how you define solar system, of course. Mm-hmm. So by that I mean 33 times the distance to Pluto. So yes, 33. Go to Pluto times 33, and that's the radius. Incredible. So a quasar though is all about the accretion disk. That's where it all happens. That's where the magic really happens in terms of creating a quasar. So now imagine I really thought of this for the first time today. Imagine the accretion disk of this hyper glowing gas around a black hole as big as a solar system. How big would the accretion disk be? Because when they tell you that the diameter is this big for the black hole, they're not talking about the accretion disk. They're talking about the event horizon, right? So how big would the accretion disk be? And I actually couldn't find out. I don't know how big the accretion disk would be for such a thing. I do know, though, I was able to find out that for a smaller, normal black hole, say, whatever, 10, 20, 30 solar masses or whatever, even more, 100, 1,000 solar masses, you can have an accretion disk up to 300 times larger than say, it had to be the event horizon. So it's big. I mean, these things they spread out. The accretion disk spreads out 300 times. So what would it be for a supermassive black hole? I mean, maybe 300 times is too much, but even if it was 100 times, I mean, imagine the size of this thing. It's just mind-boggling. It's so big that imagine that you're at the inner edge of the accretion disk, right? You're going around the black hole. You're at the inner edge. You're about to drop in through the event horizon. Mm-hmm. Even if you traveled at the speed of light, it would take you a month to go around just once, assuming you were really close to the event horizon. Mm-hmm. A whole month at the speed of light just to go around. And it's not going at the speed of light. It's going less, and it's probably much farther away. So what does it take? 2 months to go around just once. And this is so big. It's amazing. Because whenever I think of an accretion disk, I think of a smaller accretion disk around a standard black hole, you know, that's not very big. Could be, you know, I don't know, kilometers, many kilometers, not 200 billion kilometers. Oh, man, just it boggled my mind thinking about that today. And it's still feeding. Oh, yeah. Well, it was 12.5 billion years ago.
What's it doing lately?
So, yeah, that's a good question.
It went on a calorie restriction diet.
It's fasting every... So where does the energy come from? Now, people often say, and I wrote it in my notes here in my first draft, people say, ah, it's the friction. And yeah, but it's obviously more complicated than that. So I took a deep dive on that. Apparently, from what I could tell, the energy ultimately comes from the inevitable increase of gravitational binding energy as the gas in the accretion disk gets closer and closer. The gravitational binding energy, the energy holding it together, has to go up. It just has to for some reason. And when that happens, energy has to be released. And it's a little counterintuitive. As you increase the gravitational binding energy, energy has to be released. That's just the nature of the binding energy. And that energy release can be more efficient than thermonuclear reactions. It's really efficient. And the article I was reading actually said that that energy extraction is so efficient that super advanced civilizations in the deep, far future may use it to actually, you know, run their civilization. I don't know about that. I mean, if I was a super advanced civilization, I don't think I'd be hanging out near an accretion disk. I would, you know, you could get plenty of energy from the ergosphere, but I digress. So how much energy does he
One half percent of the audience maybe understood what that meant. Okay.
If you listen to me, you know exactly what I meant. So how much energy does the accretion disk of the black hole J2 release? Astronomers measured the light that the accretion disk emits, and it came to 1 quadrillion times the amount of light that the sun emits.
You just wanted to say quadrillion.
Yeah, quadrillion's a great number, great number. That's mind-boggling. Get a quadrillion suns, put it in the space of our solar system, and that's what this damn accretion disk is emitting. Incredible. Oh, but listen to this. If you know how much energy is being emitted, if you do some fancy math, which I didn't do, but if you know how much energy is being emitted, you can then calculate how much mass the black hole must be swallowing in order to release that. I couldn't do the math, but I did some of it, but I relied on experts to really do it. All right. It is swallowing the equivalent of just under 4 Earth masses every second.
4 Earths every second.
Or 1 Jupiter every 90 seconds. I calculated that on my own. Mm-hmm. And 1 sun every day. Bam! Every day. I'll take another sun, please. Every day this thing is swallowing the equivalent of the sun's mass every day. The most ravenous black hole ever discovered. I was going to do the amount of average J meatballs that it was consuming every day, but I didn't have enough time. But it would be a lot. It'd be a huge, huge. It would make be a huge, huge.
Theoretically, there could be a larger one out there.
Yes, absolutely. And there are larger black holes. Absolutely. Oh, gosh. This is not the most massive, supermassive black hole ever found. It's the biggest ever found in the universe at that age. Mm. And it's actually like, how did it get so big so fast? You know, it's definitely a little bit mysterious. And it makes me think, all right, how big is that damn black hole right now? Now it certainly could not maintain that diet forever. It definitely had some serious fasting in its future, right, Jay? Eventually, it's going to consume all the local matter, and the quasar just becomes less and less active over time. And eventually, it becomes calm, like all the nearest galaxies to us within, say, hundreds of millions of light years to us. There's no active galactic nuclei within hundreds of millions of light years of us. Because you just run out of fuel. And it makes sense that in the earlier universe, we're seeing a lot of these quasars because there's just a lot of stuff to go around. So just a fascinating story, even though this story, was a little older than I thought it was. I was like, holy crap, this story wasn't, you know, it actually was, this news was released in 2020. I was like, what? I got to find a new topic. I'm like, screw it. I'm going to talk about other interesting things related to this topic. And I did check, and this is still the most energetic and still most powerful quasar ever discovered. And this is still the biggest black hole in the universe at that time. So, but fascinating stuff. I just wanted to talk about quasars and accretion disks.
And you did. All right. On a related item, mm-hmm. well, in that it's astronomy,
Yeah.
Evan, I understand that the Webb telescope has found its first exoplanet.
That's right. Yes, they
did. Nice.
Yeah, they announced it just about a week ago. They, the researchers, as you said, Steve, used the James Webb Space Telescope, and they've used it to confirm an exoplanet. And, of course, that's a planet that orbits another star. And it is the first exoplanet discovered by the James Webb Space Telescope. So let's,
what took so long?
Let's say hello to our little friend, our new little friend, this new planet. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's how I'm going to explain it. I'm going to describe it in the first person as if the planet itself had the capability of introducing itself.
Oh, it's a talking.
So in a way, cool. It has a little chat, you know, GPT aspect to this. As if you were to type in, hey, ChatGPT, describe the new exoplanet that was discovered, but do it in the first person as if it were describing itself to a fourth grade class, let's say. All right. So that's what we're going with here. Here we go.
Which you obviously couldn't really do because it doesn't have this information.
Correct. Well, I'll tell a little story at the end about that. But I did not do that. Right. This is my own embellishment. So here we go. Okay. Hi, everyone. That's where you say hi.
Hi.
What's up, XO?
My name is LHS-475B. As you can see, I'm a rocky planet, roughly the same size as Earth. About 99% the size of Earth. Small world, huh? I live relatively close by, only 41 light years from you in the constellation Octans. Cosmically speaking, we practically live in the same apartment building. I have a parent star, that is. It's a red dwarf star, which is one of the smallest types of stars in the universe. Much smaller than your sun, with much less mass. Which is one of the reasons I've been so hard to find for this long. Your friends there on Earth, Kevin Stevenson and Jacob Lustig Jaeger, both of the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland, along with their team of researchers, found me recently using your way super cool James Webb telescope back in August of last year. But partial credit has to go to your Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS, which initially hinted at my existence. The James Webb Space Telescope confirmed those suspicions. Webb's near-infrared spectrograph, or the NIR spec, found me rather clearly and easily with only 2 transit observations. Can you believe that?
Nice.
I wish I had a telescope, but sadly I don't, because I'm not exactly a prime candidate planet for advanced life to have been created. I mean, evolved. That's because I orbit very close to my red dwarf star. I orbit around the star in just 2 of my days. So you can tell that I'm very close to my star, so close that I'm considered tidally locked. And that means I don't rotate like Earth does once every 23 hours and 56 minutes. Nope, I'm locked, with one side of me always facing the star and the other side always facing away. Some more about me. Let's see. Oh, I'm warm. Like, very warm. About 300 degrees Celsius is my estimated surface temperature. But I'm not really sure what kind of atmosphere I have, or if I even have an atmosphere at all.
You don't.
As your friend Aaron May of the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory recently said, I quote, "We can't yet make any definitive conclusions about the planet's atmosphere." Your researchers have ruled out certain types of atmospheres, though. For instance, they say I do not have a thick methane-dominated atmosphere similar to that of Saturn's moon Titan. And while it's possible that I have no atmosphere at all, they are saying that perhaps, just perhaps, my atmosphere could be something extraordinary, like a 100% carbon dioxide atmosphere. An atmosphere like that would be so compact that even the amazing James Webb Space Telescope instruments might have a tough time detecting such an atmosphere. I'm special. The good thing is that your awesome space scientists are going to perform additional research to try and find out more about me. The researchers are scheduled to obtain additional spectra with upcoming observations this coming summer. I wish I had a summer. I'm not even sure my axis tilts. Well, I have to go now, but don't worry, you'll see me when I transit again in about 2 days.
Now, you said two of my days. Isn't it two Earth days?
You meant your days.
Did I say that? Oh, you see, you see how these things, you know, always, you know, sometimes get the facts wrong. They need to fact check these things a little better. Good catch.
Yeah. So recently, by coincidence, I did an updated article. I like to find, like, what's the most Earth-like exoplanets we've discovered so far? And we really haven't found a really good Earth match. Most of the quote-unquote Earth-like planets, of course, you have to define what do you mean by Earth-like. So let's say roughly Earth size, rocky, in the habitable zone of your star. Usually that's what they're talking about. But the habitable zone,
love it.
Is just the distance at which you could have liquid water on the surface. But it doesn't take into account spectrum and surface gravity necessarily, and are they tidally locked? So most quote-unquote Earth-like planets that get reported are surrounding red dwarfs, which means they're not good candidates for life. Or the red dwarfs are very active. They're especially early on. So you know, there's still this idea that maybe a planet could either reconstitute its atmosphere or it could settle in to a closer orbit from outside the solar system later on in the life of the red dwarfs when it's settled down. But settled down still could mean 1,000 times more active than a yellow sun like our sun. So it's still controversial whether or not red dwarfs can have planets in the habitable zone with an atmosphere, but it's not looking good.
Yeah.
So it's just not going to be a good candidate to look for a really Earth-like planet. But there really isn't even a single exoplanet that has, close to Earth surface gravity that's in the habitable zone of an orange to yellow star, you know, even those things, those three things, like all together where it could be a truly Earth-like candidate. We haven't found one yet.
It could be an Earth-like candidate. Oh, you said all together, sir.
Let alone one only 41 light years away, which is very close. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, when you said that, the first thing I thought was, why the hell didn't we find it already? 41's close.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, it's hard to find red dwarf.
It was hard to find, yep. But James Webb found it. First one, first of many, let's hope.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. So, any ideas?
7200 baud dial-up. Thank you.
Is it a sonification of a data stream of some type?
I don't really like doing sonifications, and I told you if I do use one, I will tell you it's a sonification.
Yes, Steve, he told you.
It is not. I told you, okay?
But it was a long time ago. I thought maybe you forgot.
Well, Benjamin Greenberg wrote it. And hi, Jay, long-time listener, first-time guessing. Might be totally off here, but the clicking noise in the background reminds me of analog tape decks. There's an interesting play on how each tone and its oscillation pattern starts incrementally and plays on each other before stopping incrementally as well. That being said, maybe some type of synthesizer through an analog tape delay system. So that is not correct. Very interesting guess, though. And I think you hit on a couple of maybe ideas there that might lead to what this thing is. Michael Blaney wrote in, said, hi, Jay. Okay, it's not a UFO. Of that, I'm pretty sure. I'm going for a 14400 baud modem failing to make a connection. So that's what Evan thought as well.
Mm-hmm.
And another guess is David Moule Richardson said, this is probably wrong, but I remember hearing the 1970s BBC radio adaptation of Isaac Asimov's initial Foundation trilogy at university, and this week's sound was strongly reminiscent of the odd soundtrack the BBC Radiophonic Workshop provided. And I could, I totally can see that. You know, it has the kind of sound that when people who are making sci-fi would be like, yeah, we should use that, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I'll get right to the winners now. So this is one of those things that if you know it, you know it. And if you don't know it, like most of us, then you really have no idea. First, I'll start with Visto Tutti because he got very close. He says, sounds like shortwave radio transmitting data. Perhaps it is the famous Explorer 1 satellite launched by the U.S. in response to the Sputnik satellite. So this is radio transmission. You are correct, but there's a lot more detail here. So the person who got it right first, Gunther Helmut, wrote in and said, sounds like FT8 digital mode communication for amateur radio on HF band. Okay, so that is correct, but let me tell you what the hell this is.
Wow.
Let me tell you what it is.
You got it.
You did get it.
Oh.
So the person that wrote in a very good explanation is named Tim Haywood.
Really?
Haywood. Right? Don't say it.
No.
Don't say it. Holy shit, it's right there.
I'm thinking it.
He said... He said, hi, guys. Tim the patron here, as all hams who listen to the Noisy this week will know, that sound is audio of FT8 mode where a bunch of hams, or a ham meaning a person that uses a ham radio, right? So if you don't know what a ham radio is, it's time for you to pause the show and look it up and read up on what that is and then come back. So he said, where a bunch of hams are sending short digital messages to each other all over the world. It's one of the many digital modes that have been developed by hams and currently the most popular in addition to the traditional analog voice and Morse code modes. In fact, I was just doing FT8 this morning. So from my understanding, it's a protocol to communicate with other people who are communicating with people over ham radio. And this is sending like a initial packet of information identifying like this is who I am and this is where I am kind of information. And then from there, you can pick who you want to talk to. So it's kind of like an initial communication that gives base data to other people who are on the system. You know what I mean? Probably can be explained much better than that. But I know nothing of ham radio. I know nothing. I just know it's expensive.
The information's decoded in some way then?
Yeah, so that it is. It is decoded because it's sending out, from what I gather, it's sending out like the initial like, hi, this is who I am and this is where I'm at. So then, you know, you could, and it can read all of them at the same time. Like your radio receiver can read all of those signals from all over the world at the same time.
Almost like maybe a transponder, maybe.
Kind of, I guess in a sense, but I think you're able to pluck out of all of that noise, like the people that you know, and you can connect.
Yeah, like an airplane sends out a signal saying, hey, this is this airplane, and it can be picked up by all sorts of things.
Yeah, that's what I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Very interesting sound. I mean, just I won't play the whole thing again, but just listen to all these different signals happening at the same time.
Jeez, it has an outer limits kind of sound to it, doesn't it?
Somebody explained that this thing that we're hearing could be hundreds or even thousands of transmissions at the same time.
Whoa. Wow. Whoa. You really need a machine to pick
that
out.
It's really cool sounding. Yeah. Very interesting stuff there. All right, I got a new sound, new noisy for you guys this week, sent in by a listener we all know, Craig Good.
Yay, Craig.
Yeah, he sends me good noisies every once in a while. I may have played this one before. That's my only clue. There's something tickling me in the back of the head that I may have played this, but if I did, it was quite a long time ago. So it's worthy. It's really awesome. So check this out. Let me play that again for you.
That sounded creepy, man.
It's those member berries from South Park.
If you guys
a marine
think,
mammal, gonna lose it.
If you, it's, I'm gonna tell you right now, it's not a freaking marine mammal. Okay? That is a whole category right there. I know. But again, Kara, isn't it funny? Because you know, you start to realize how. There's so many things that are out there that sound like other things. You know, what is this thing?
For sure.
If you think you know what this noisy is or you want to send me in something cool that you heard this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, did you know that if you become a patron of the SGU, not only do you already get premium content, which you know you will only have access to because you're a patron, but you will also get access to an early release of all of the new YouTube videos that you and I are producing right now. These are happening right now.
Right now.
So you'll get two weeks of early release on basically anything that we do with this new project that Steve and I are doing, which is, so we're making YouTube videos where I ask Steve a science question and he answers it. We have a conversation. Pandemonium ensues.
Pandemonium.
And patrons will get early access to that content. And we're also making, we said this last week, and I'm super excited because we just made a few more yesterday. We are on TikTok. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine old white men on TikTok? This is fun. Steve is doing a couple of different things here. He is doing, we're finding ridiculous stuff on TikTok, and Steve's doing a quick takedown on whatever that ridiculous thing is. Or Steve is explaining a concept in about 3 minutes, something that a science enthusiast or a person who's trying to learn about skepticism and critical thinking that you'd probably want to hear and learn about. So, but we're having a lot of fun because if you can imagine, we're sifting through like all of these ridiculous things.
All this
we're
crazy stuff.
Yeah. Should we talk about this? This is even too crazy. You know, this time we made one that you should, that's probably up by now, where these people think they're seeing a UFO and they're freaking out. You know, they're like totally like, oh my God. It's really funny. And then Steve gets in there and tells you what the hell's happening. Yeah. You can go to our TikTok at tiktok.com/skepticsguide.
All right. Thanks, Jay. We're going to do one email. This one comes from Giles, or is it Giles? I'm going to say Giles.
Probably Giles.
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 I say Giles.
I say.
And of course, he starts with, I read a BBC article today that suggests that the use of coffee pods might actually be less damaging to the environment than more traditional ways of making coffee. They mention filter coffee and French presses being two examples of methods that might be more damaging than using coffee pods. He goes on to say some nice things about how the Skeptics Guide helped him to think critically and skeptically about this and other topics. But that's his basic question. Is this correct? You know, this idea that, and this has been going around the intertubes recently. It's actually old news. You can find articles from 2019 talking about the same kind of information. Kara, what's your reaction? What's your just honest, immediate reaction to this idea that the coffee pods are actually better for the environment than other ways of making coffee?
Yeah, I mean, my gut is like, there's no freaking way.
Yeah.
That's like, and so I saw this going around too, and I haven't had time to read it. So I am really curious, like by what measure?
Exactly. That's of course the key question, by what measure?
Because it's the same thing when people go, reusable shopping bags are terrible.
Yeah.
Think about how long it takes to make one. And it's like, yeah, but we're not just talking about raw materials. We're also talking about what goes back into the landfills. Mm-hmm.
So, all right. What the article is talking about, and again, I found ones going back even to like 2019, is the carbon footprint. Right. So that's just one way of looking at how bad, quote unquote, how bad it is for the environment. But if you look at carbon footprint, the best way to make coffee is with instant coffee. It is
that makes sense.
It is the most efficient because the coffee grounds get freeze dried. They get converted into the crystals and then they get you completely convert them into coffee. There isn't any coffee grounds left behind and you're heating up exactly the amount of water that you need for the coffee that you're going to drink. And so in many ways, it's coffee bean efficient, it's water efficient, and it's ultimately the most carbon efficient way of making coffee. The high end, like pour over, French press, whatever, the barista way of making it, that's the worst. That it uses the most energy. It uses the most water and it uses the most coffee. And of course, you think about the carbon footprint of coffee, it's mostly from growing the coffee. So anything that uses the coffee beans themselves less efficiently is going to have a much larger carbon footprint than anything that uses those coffee beans more efficiently. Now let's talk about the coffee pods. They have the advantage of using less water. They don't have to use as much energy to heat that water. And they use less in terms of the amount of coffee itself in order to make your individual cups of coffee. So from a carbon footprint point of view, it is more efficient than other kinds of coffee, even when you consider the carbon footprint of creating the pods, the packs.
The plastic cups.
The individual cups of coffee.
Interesting.
If you do a lifetime analysis, cradle to grave analysis of the carbon footprint, it's still better. It is still, but not as good as freeze dried, but it's better than the other ones. But of course, that's only when you're asking, what has the lowest carbon footprint? and not considering what puts the most plastic into the environment. If that's your question, then obviously the individual, you know, single-use plastic coffee pods are not good. Right. In fact, the British producer, according to research by Halo, a British producer of compostable coffee capsules, every minute about 39,000 of these pods are made worldwide, while up to 29,000 are dumped in landfill sites. Every minute, 29,000 get dumped in the landfill sites. But here's the thing. You don't have to use plastic. They also come in recyclable aluminum pods, and those are much better. So if you use the aluminum pods, you're actually getting the best of both worlds. You're getting, you know, the second best, lowest carbon footprint, and you're using recyclable aluminum, so you're not putting any single-use plastic into the waste stream. They also make reusable pods as well, if you'd like to use...
I've seen those.
The, mm-hmm. Yeah, the efficiency of that system, but you don't want to have the pods as in the waste stream. So, guys, you all have to start drinking instant coffee. I'm sorry.
Nope, I refuse.
Why don't you have a nice Sanka?
Have a Sanka, yeah.
I drank instant coffee in the Peruvian Amazon. That's the last time I drank it. It tasted really good there, but no, at home I have a system and a routine, and I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to keep doing what I do.
You make it up in other ways.
I can't keurig it up.
You make it up in other ways, Kara.
Yeah,
you know?
I make it
up
in electric cars.
I don't have a car, dude.
Yeah,
like
coffee. Right?
Yeah.
I haven't driven a car in like months. Like I can have my coffee the way I want it.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to live your life, right? but looking for those places where you could make an improvement without making a compromise, this sounded like a familiar conversation, mm-hmm. Is, I think, a good way to go. It's like, well, if you could shave some, you know, some carbon off of your coffee habit without compromising the whole process and the enjoyment and the quality of the coffee that you get, et cetera, then you would do it, right?
So, yeah. And also, I think the manufacturers should be thinking about that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, how can they, if they can make certain changes that make it more water, you know, less water intensive.
I like the move to aluminum. Like, now, like, you can get, like, instead of bottled whatever, it just comes in aluminum. And
I don't understand, because I use an espresso machine. So I just put the raw beans in the top. It grinds them. It has a little water reservoir.
It's terrible in terms of carbon footprint. You're using a lot more beans. First of all, you're using burning electricity to do that whole process. So you got to count the carbon footprint of the electricity, as well as the growing of the coffee, the amount of coffee. And then you're also putting the coffee grounds into the waste stream, which is...
Yeah, I am putting plastic, coffee grounds, although those are compostable.
Those are compostable, yeah.
So but I'm confused, because whether I'm grinding the whole beans for one cup, or in the earlier manufacturing process, all the beans are being ground.
Yeah, I think there's economy of scale, you know, where if you're doing it individually, it's not good. Plus, you end up using more water. You know,
right. I'm probably definitely using more water, but I'm not using any packaging. Yeah. So there is that trade-off.
Yeah, right. But it does show you how complicated these questions are, and then you make immediate assumptions. Like, of course, those pods are the worst. It's like, actually, it's more complicated than that, depending on how you want to look at it, you know? And again, that's the same thing with the plastic bags. It's like, yeah, you don't want to put that single-use plastic bags into the waste stream, but they are pretty efficient in other ways, you know, so there is a trade-off. There's lots of trade-offs. And the reusable bags may cost a lot more carbon and energy to make them, but if you use them for years, they pay off. You just have to use them for a long time in order to get the payback of the extra energy cost of making them in the first place.
Yeah.
Which, you know, why wouldn't you use them forever? Just don't lose them. You know, just keep using the ones that you've had. They should last forever. All right. Interesting question. Thank you, Jaws. But that's definitely making the rounds. So it's good to weigh in on that. All right, everyone, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. There's a theme this week, technological advances. All right, so these are just news items that all relate in one way or another to some kind of a technological advance.
Ugh, you might as well call them me first.
Okay.
I will offer zero information to anybody on the panel. So.
All right, here we go. They're not as bad as you think. Item number one. A Japanese company will market MRAM memory chips this year that use new technology to achieve terahertz switching speeds, 1,000 times faster than existing RAM. All right, number two, researchers have created a hybrid cultivar of cotton.
It's a hybrid.
That is naturally fire resistant and under testing will self-extinguish if ignited. Item number three, a California company announced it will roll out the first mass-produced solar-powered car this year. Kara, you go first.
All right. I'm going to go in reverse order because I feel like a California company rolling out a mass-produced solar-powered car sounds feasible. Because it says literally nothing about its range. And I think about my very first electric car and its range was 80 miles. And it did me fine. Like living in LA, I didn't need more than 80 miles in a day before I charged it.
You want to hear the range? So you're going first. I'll give you more information if you want it.
Oh, sure.
They're saying that the car will have a range of 500 miles.
Oh, that's
amazing. Right, because if it's a sunny day out.
You know. No, that's not including the sun. That's just on one charge of the battery.
Ooh.
If you include the sun, then they give all kinds of numbers depending on conditions. But it's
that's cool. And I do think there are, I mean, I feel like I've heard of solar cars being available now. So I feel like the question then is that it's like mass produced. So yeah, I don't know. I don't see why that wouldn't be the case.
What does solar powered in this context mean?
It means it can run.
What are we supposed to mean?
It can run entirely on solar power.
So the solar power charges the battery.
Mm-hmm.
All
yeah,
right.
Yeah. That makes sense. Researchers created a hybrid, cultivar of cotton. That's naturally fire resistant. And by naturally, you mean.
I mean, they don't add any fire retardant.
Right. But it's not, but you don't mean naturally as in it's not transgenic. Well, it's hybrid.
Well, it's not. It's hybrid.
Oh, okay.
It's
so they just found two. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they found something that was had a fire resistant property and they bred it with kind of traditional cotton. And then under testing, when it was ignited, it would self-extinguish. So that part's interesting because I would think if it was fire-resistant, it couldn't even ignite. But I guess anything can ignite if you, like, blowtorch it. So then it puts out its own fire. Yeah, why not? Why can't? I mean, I think a lot of crops don't catch on fire. I guess cotton maybe is known for catching on fire. But, like, I know living in L.A., there are recommendations for how you should plant your backyards to prevent fire from spreading. So that if there is a forest fire or wildfire, if you have certain vegetation, it can actually protect your house because it's like, yeah, fire won't consume it. So yeah, that one I buy too. So I think it's the MRAM one, the one that I literally don't understand. Technology to achieve terahertz switching speeds. I don't even know. I think we're in the gigas right now with RAM. So Tera is 1,000 times faster. Okay, sure. But these chips might not have anything to do with like a normal computer. This might be used for some technology that's not like consumer technology. So, and yeah, why not? I mean, they all sound feasible. No, that one's not feasible. I'm going to say that's the fiction. Screw it. I'm putting down my nickel.
Which one? Which one?
The MRAM. Okay. MRAM's not happening this year. Thank you.
Okay, Jay.
All right. Well, Kara.
Uh-huh.
I hate to say this, but I think the one that's most likely here is the MRAM.
Oh, interesting.
MRAM memory chips this year that use new technology to achieve terahertz switching speeds. Yeah, I just think that one, you know, there's so many companies out there that are building chips and trying to improve chip technology. This just doesn't surprise me at all, what Steve wrote here. Going to the second one, researchers that created a hybrid cultivar of cotton. Yeah, it's hard. I don't know. I don't really know if could it be fire resistant. I would imagine, sure. Okay, there's got to be something in it that, you know, retards the fire. Yeah, I'm half on the fence with that one. But the one that I really don't jive with is this California company that announced the mass-produced solar-powered car. Now you said it's going to get 500 miles per charge, Steve.
That's what they're saying.
Yeah, I don't think that's possible. I think that was a fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Did everyone go?
Nope. Evan
no.
Evan, you go. Go ahead, Evan.
And Bob.
All right.
With
forget
the confidence.
That was a very good. I'll appreciate the opening, but I'm good.
No, I'll go. Yeah, solar car, no.
Damn it.
Mm.
And Evan.
Well.
There's not enough room. There's not enough space. Unless I'm making assumptions here and it has in its trunk this gargantuan solar panel that you spread out that's as big as the damn, I don't know, 10 by 10, 20 by 20 is not enough real estate to charge your car with the sun. I don't care what about the breakthroughs we've made in solar panels, and we have. You'd be sitting there for an hour to get 2 minutes of ride time. That's just like, yeah. It's not, we're not ready. That's not going to happen. There's not enough real estate.
Okay.
And Evan?
I'm going to start with the middle one.
Okay.
Sure. Cotton, naturally fire resistant. Inflammable means flammable? What a country. I just wanted to say that. Either, this was an opening to use that.
Either it flams or it doesn't.
For you Simpsons fans. But I'll jump right to the one I think is the fiction. I think it's the car. The reason I think the car one is the fiction is that I think they invented the car. I don't think it's mass produced, though. They got a test or something, one model, and maybe is doing all this. But mass produced, I don't think so.
Okay, so you all agree on the second one. So let's start there. Researchers have created a hybrid cultivar of cotton that is naturally fire resistant and under testing will self-extinguish if ignited. You all think this one is science. And this one is science. Is it science?
Yeah. Okay.
You're all safe so
cool.
far.
Cool, very cool.
It is very cool. And what's interesting is that the parent species that they started with were not fire resistant. But they, you know, with the right combination of genes, they were able to create, you know, some cultivars that were fire resistant. And the winner, you know, that was the best, was had a very high degree of fire resistance. So it was obviously harder to ignite. And then, and when they did basically set it on fire, it wouldn't propagate. It would just extinguish itself. Whereas normal cotton would just, the whole thing would burn. Like the flame would just consume the whole strip of cotton that they were testing. Yeah. So it's like without having to add flame retardant chemicals, which is very controversial in terms of their environmental effects, et cetera. Basically, you could just, you know, have, you know, the natural cotton untreated that is itself fire resistant. Again, we don't say fireproof. The thing can burn enough heat, enough flame, but it's resistant to the flame and wouldn't necessarily propagate it, which is, of course, the important thing. Yeah, so that one is science. So let's go back to number one. A Japanese company will market MRAM memory chips this year that use new technology to achieve terahertz switching speeds 1,000 times faster than existing RAM. Kara, you think this one is the fiction. The boys all think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Science. It's the fiction. What? No way.
Yeah. What? I win and I don't know anything about what I'm talking about?
No way, man. This is bullshit.
Yes.
So, I can't wait to hear the bullshit with this card.
Sorry, I'll tell you about that. All right, but now this is based on a real story. So they are researching an MRAM chip using anti-ferromagnetic tunnel junctions, which could theoretically allow, they're projecting up to a terahertz switching speed, but this is still in development. They're not marketing it this year. This was just a sort of, they just figured out something about the technology. Again, so it's still years away. But the idea is, you know, with the ferromagnetic RAM chips, you have to line up all of the strips and of, you know, the magnetic pieces, and that creates a magnetic field which limits the speed that the switches can switch, right? But with the anti-ferromagnetic pieces, you can align them in such a way that there's no net magnetic field, right? You don't have to make them all parallel. And that would allow for much faster switching, and they calculate that they should be able to get into the terahertz range with this technology. So this may be something that's rolling off the assembly line in 5 to 10 years, and this is just laying some of the theoretical groundwork. Anti-ferromagnetic tunnel junctions, which can be much faster. So yeah, just fiction because it's 5 to 10 years ahead of its time, which means a California company announced it will roll out the first mass-produced solar-powered car this year is science. The company is Aptera. They've been working on this for a while. Their goal was to make the most fuel-efficient car possible so that it could be feasibly powered by solar panels. It's a three-wheeled vehicle two-seater, so obviously it's small. It's not the kind of thing you're going to be chugging the family around with or taking on the construction site or whatever. But it would be perfectly fine for most commutes. You know, most people...
Three wheels.
Is that even technically a car?
Yeah, it's like a little city car. You know what's smart, too, is that this could be good for, like city car, kind of the city bikes, where they're just in parking spaces around the city and you can just borrow them.
They went with three wheels because it's less friction and improved fuel efficiency.
You know, all right, get to the meat.
And all right, so it's basically an electric car, right, first and foremost. It has a battery. It can go 500 miles on a single charge. But it also, the roof is designed to be as long and flat as possible, not only to be aerodynamic, but to maximize the surface area for the solar panels that are included.
And so is it made of aerogel? Is that
it's made of carbon fiber, again, to be maximally light. Yeah. And they have, like, all of the electronics use LED lights and are in, like, the low energy mode. And everything is, like, optimized for efficiency. And they have, you know, the car self-cools in a way that minimizes your need for air conditioning. Like, all they did everything they could to make the electricity use.
Top speed.
So if you have a sunny day, top speed was 81 miles per hour.
That's respectable.
Acceleration's huge. It accelerates really fast. So it's a peppy, fast vehicle. That's not a problem. It's a real car.
Yeah, that's like electric vehicles are fast as shit off the line.
Yeah,
the torque is off the hook.
But how long does it take to charge?
All right. So, the question is, if you have, say, a sunny day, how far could you drive on one day's solar recharging?
And the answer is, if you had zero miles, just whatever, sat in the sun.
How many miles would the sun put into the battery in one day? That's the question.
Mm-hmm. I'd guess like 50, 100?
40 okay, miles.
Yeah. So it does take a week.
24 hours.
No, not 24 hours, Bob. No,
you said a day.
The sun doesn't shine for 24 hours.
I thought it's out all day in California.
No, yeah. So obviously there's a lot of variables here. It's going to work a lot better the closer you are to the equator and the longer and the more you are in the middle of the summer versus the middle of the winter.
Oh, yeah.
You're not going to get 40 miles on a winter day in Connecticut. But it's
a piece of crap solar car because think about that. You drive to work, you come home, you're near empty.
No, Bob.
It's night. The sun has set.
Charge the car first.
Bob, the car has a 500-mile range. You're not going – right? It has a battery.
Charge it electrically in the wall so that you have all 500 miles, then go out and drive in the sun. Right. And then it's going to constantly re-up itself.
Right. So the point is that if your commute is less than 40 miles a day, which is – 40 miles a day is the average distance that most drivers drive.
You don't even need to plug in.
Right. Then you're basically driving off solar energy. That 40-mile-a-day average amount that drivers drive could be entirely on solar energy. But then you've got a 500-mile range. And, in fact, the range is more than 500 miles. The range is 500 miles just on the battery. And then you add to that whatever you get off the solar panels while you're driving, which could, you know, if you basically drive during the day, you might be able to add another 40 miles to that. But in some of the write-ups, they said it had like a 1,000-mile range. I don't know what they're talking about. I think they might be talking about if you under certain driving conditions, like if you're not – that doesn't mean all at once. If you're commuting
even 1,000 is a big
– It's always pointless. It's pointless. Then somebody said 3,000-mile range. It's pointless. The fact is the battery gives you 500 miles and the solar panels recharge 40 miles a day. Those are the only two numbers that matter. And everything else is all condition dependent or whatever.
Interesting.
I want one. Do you know how much they cost? I want to order one.
$195,000.
No, I bet you they're cheap because they're small.
$23,000, $24,000. Yeah.
$23,000? Yeah. That's not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad.
I would never drive a super light three-wheel thing that's going to be your coffin.
Yeah, but you also have to – you just have to think about where the market is for these kinds of things. City drivers. The same people who – if you would be comfortable riding a bicycle with a helmet in traffic where you drive, I don't see why you would be uncomfortable driving this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be a niche car. No question.
Maybe niche in huge cities. I mean, that's the thing we sometimes forget about. Like, most of the people in our country live in cities where a car like this would make sense.
The other thing is it's also, even if the car itself may only have a niche, mainly because it's small, it's a two-seater, you know, there's no trunk space, basically. But even given that the other point of developing this car was just to almost theoretically, how fuel efficient could we make a car, an all electric car? And so this may have some ideas and technology which could get adapted to more traditional full electric vehicles to make them more fuel efficient, you know, and maybe up the range of existing cars, or, you know, up their fuel efficiency. So it is just about the technology itself, not necessarily the specific application of it, which I still think, I agree, Kara, it's cool. It will have a niche. I will never buy one. I need a bigger car. But for a lot of applications, this is all people need. It's a great commuter car.
I also think, like, I don't think it's as niche as you're saying.
Well, we'll see.
Like, the vast majority of people live in cities.
Europeans may love it. Who knows? They drive those tiny little cars.
Yeah, Europeans may love it. I think a lot of people are single. A lot of people don't have children. Mm-hmm. Like, we think of the norm as, like, the nuclear family living
in the suburbs. Isn't everybody like me, though, Kara?
Exactly. But, like, that's the thing. That's,
I thought you were the center
of the
universe.
You actually are not representative of, like, the typical American.
I have 2.4 kids. That's representative.
That's not the norm anymore.
I never met the 0.4th kid.
Yeah. I hear you, but I'm just saying, yes, there is a segment of the population for whom this might be a perfect application.
But it's not
going to be widely adopted. It's not going to be an every person car, because there are limitations.
That was kind of why
about
I
how
went,
easy it would be to park.
But that's why I was going with, like, mass produce this. Do they have pre-orders on this thing? They must.
I don't know if they have pre-orders, but they're still tweaking the design, but they are going into mass production this year. They said the company announced they will roll out the first mass produced car this year. So we'll see if it actually happens or not. They just announced that they're going to do it.
Yeah, you can reserve yours now.
Yeah, and then they also need to get approval, you know, for the car, because, you know, it's a new car. They need to get the stamp of approval. So probably next year or the year after is when you could actually buy one, get it delivered, and start driving it.
That's a little tricky.
They have $100 million in pre-orders already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just look it up. Yeah.
Yep.
The Aptera 2E is the car.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So you're saying that we lost.
I'm saying that you lost. Yeah.
Oh, wait. No, it's way higher now. This was an old article. Over 30,000 reservations, which represents over $1 billion in total pre-order value.
Awesome.
That's really cool.
Yeah. All right. Good job, Kara.
Thanks.
Yeah, Kara. Nice work.
Neat.
All right. Evan.
Whatever.
Love you, Bob.
Give us a quote.
Love you, too.
The quote,
damn it.
The quote this week was suggested by a listener. His name's Trano, T-R-A-N-O. Thank you, Trano, from France. It says, "Hi there. I heard someone in a favorite podcast of mine say this quote. You cannot reason someone out of something he or she was not reasoned into." And I'm still reading the email here, which I thought was very interesting. According to Quote Investigator, it's from Jonathan Swift. Although other similar quotes also exist, and he gives a link to that. Recently started the audiobook version of The Skeptic's Guide to the Future. Exciting stuff. Greetings from Paris, and thanks for the awesome show. Thank you, Trano.
Yeah, thank you. That's
and
nice.
Yeah, that is a quote that I think I've heard and maybe tweaked a little bit, or just in a different way.
I've heard that quote many times, and I've heard it from skeptical speakers. I forget who I first heard it from. I didn't realize that was from Jonathan Swift originally. Yeah. It's just been bouncing around the skeptical movement for the last 30 years, because it's a great quote, you know?
It is a great quote. And, you know, going back to the 17th century, good stuff with Jonathan Swift.
Yeah, he was it's a real intellectual, that guy. Pretty cool. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure,
thank
man.
You, Steve.
You got it, man.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.